In the 15th chapter of the book of Luke, there's a story that will be well known to many of you about the prodigal son. And I'd like to read to you from verses 20 through 32. We're cutting in to the story. The son has gone away and he's returning home. So in verse 20 of Luke chapter 15, it says this: "And he arose and came to his father. But when he was still a great way off, his father saw him and had compassion and ran and fell on his neck and kissed him. And the son said to him, 'Father, I have sinned against heaven and in your sight, and am no longer worthy to be called your son.' But the father said to his servants, 'Bring out the best robe and put it on him, and put a ring on his hand and sandals on his feet, and bring the fatted calf here and kill it, and let us eat and be merry. For my son was dead and is alive again. He was lost and is found.' And they began to be merry. Now his older son was in the field. And as he came and drew near to the house, he heard music and dancing. And so he called one of the servants and asked what these things meant. And he said to him, 'Your brother has come, and because he has received him safe and sound, your father has killed the fatted calf.' But he was angry and would not go in, and therefore his father came out and pleaded with him. So he answered and said to his father, 'Lo, these many years I have been serving you. I never transgressed your commandment at any time, and yet you never gave me a young goat that I might make merry with my friends. But as soon as this son of yours came, who has devoured your livelihood with harlots, you killed the fatted calf for him.' And he said to him, 'Son, you are always with me, and all that I have is yours. But it was right that we should make merry and be glad, for your brother was dead and is alive again, and was lost and is found.'" If you've heard a sermon or two in your life, you have heard the preacher blow a good sermon by not stopping when he should. That's just part of preaching. And if you've heard more than a dozen sermons, you've seen that happen. The preacher's preaching, and he gets what he has to a climax, and this is a great place to have a prayer and an altar call, but he doesn't stop there. He keeps going, and he sort of blows his sermon. Now, it seems to me that, at least on the surface, that Jesus is doing this. I mean, Jesus is the greatest preacher to ever live, and he is in prime form here. This is one of his great parables, and it just seems to me that in verse 24, he's got a good altar call. The parable has progressed. He's talking about this boy who left home, asked for the inheritance, took it all, left home, and then it seems like the point of the parable is that God is the kind of God who gets off his throne and throws his crown up in the air when a prodigal returns home. And so that's what happens. A prodigal comes to his senses. He comes home and the fatted calf is killed. And in verse 24, it says, let's make merry. Let's have a party. And so it seems to me that that would be, in one sense, the natural conclusion to the story. That's it. There's a party. God loves it when the prodigals come home. This kid who was lost is now found. And so that's it. That's the conclusion. But then in verse 25, it says, now he had a brother. You're like, oh, he just blew it. That was it. And he just, there he goes again. But as you read this story, and as you go back into the chapter and do, I guess, some investigation and some reflection, Jesus is the master storyteller, and you discover he really hasn't blown it. Perhaps the point is not so much that the prodigal returns home and that there's this party, and it's certainly true that God embraces the prodigals and gets off the throne and rejoices when the prodigals come home, but as you again go back to the beginning of the chapter, it seems like maybe there's a bigger point than all of that, because in verse 3 of this chapter, it says that Jesus told a parable or a story. There's really three stories, but there's just one point. The first story of this three-story parable is of a sheep that gets lost, and he wanders out into the darkness, into the far country, and the shepherd leaves the 99, and he pursues into the darkness that lost sheep. And then there's the story of a woman who's in a house, and she has 10 coins, but she loses one of the coins, and so she searches the house for the coin. You have a sheep that's lost in the far country, a coin that's lost in the house, and then it comes together. There's a son who's lost in the far country, and then you say, oh, the bigger point is that there's two ways to be lost, isn't there? That's the point. The son that left is the sheep. The son that stayed is the lost coin in the house. And so, again, the story is, oh, there's more than one way to be lost. That's the point of the story. And so I want to talk to you about this second son in that context for our time together. And I want to talk to you about why he's lost in the house, what that looks like, and maybe if that is reflective of your life, what the Bible would say that you ought to be doing. These two sons, you see that they're very much different, but they're very much alike, don't you? I mean, in one sense, you've got the son who left home, and he's a rebel. I mean, he wants his inheritance. He wants to go to the far country, and he wants to sip wine, and he wants to date a lot of women, and he wants to spend all the money. And so he's very unlike his more stable older brother, who stays home, and he's going to be a caretaker in the house, and he's gonna work on the farm, and he's probably gonna live there his entire life, and he's gonna raise kids, he's gonna get married, raise kids, and so he's gonna stay there. And on the surface, they don't look anything alike. One's, you know, riding a Harley, wearing a leather jacket, and one's wearing khakis and a long sleeve shirt, and wearing, you know, loafers. And so they don't look anything alike on the surface, and it's easy to say, well, these are two very unlike people, but you also notice, don't you, that at the core, they're very much the same. I think that you pick that up, because what do they want? They both want to be happy at the father's expense. Neither one really cares about the father, do they? The older one wants to be happy. I mean, the younger one wants to be happy. And so for him, happiness is, let's take the money and run. Let's go to Vegas. Let's set up an apartment. Let's find the pretty girls. Let's find the bars. Let's spend the money. Let's eat, drink, and be happy on the father's dime. See, the older one, to him, that's not what happiness looks like. To him, happiness is, let's stay home. I mean, you can't be happy chasing a bunch of women all over Las Vegas. Happiness is finding the right one and getting married and settled down. You can't get happy getting drunk every night because you wake up with a hangover. Happiness is a nice, simple lifestyle. Happiness isn't staying out till 3 o'clock in the morning. Happiness is going to bed at 10 o'clock at night and sleeping through it and working the farm. I mean, happiness isn't blowing money. Happiness is having money in the bank. But he's using the father to get it. The younger son wants what he wants, and he takes it and runs and pursues his version of happiness. But the older one's got a different ideal of what happiness looks like. And so happiness is staying home with a white picket fence. But he's still, using the Father to get it. He's taking his inheritance and he's staying home and living this very stable life. The other one took his inheritance and ran out and blew it. But neither one care about the Father, really, as the story progresses. Both only care about their own happiness, and they're both using the Father in their own way to obtain the happiness. I mean, we have prodigals like the younger brother everywhere. They've taken the energy and the vitality that God has given to them. In many ways, our health is an inheritance from God. I mean, he gives us life, so they've taken the life that he's given to them. This world belongs to him. He hasn't given us anything in the world. He's made us stewards of the world. We're not owners of anything, but they have taken sort of the Father's world, and they've used it to maximize their selfish, self-centered happiness. A variety of ways. But you also have older brothers who look at that and they can see through all of that stuff, but they're still very much in God for what they can get out of him. Only what they want out of him is just a little different. I've told the story here about the girl John Gerstner tells about, who wanted to be a missionary to China. And while other kids were out playing and doing sports, from from the age of 12, 13, 14, her goal was to be a missionary to China. So while in high school, she learned how to speak Chinese, and she prepared herself to go to China. Now, this was in the 1940s, and so you had the war, and then you had the Chinese Revolution after the war. So it was a very unsafe place to be for a Westerner, but she wanted to go. She felt called to go to China. She's 18 years old. She graduates. She knows the Chinese language. She's prepared herself. She goes, and nobody will send an 18-year-old to China. That would be a suicide mission for her. And they say, the only way that we will send you to China is if you're married. And so she got down on her knees, and she prayed, Lord, you see my predicament. I'm prepared to go, and there's only one thing stopping me, and could it be tall and have blue eyes? That's all that I ask. And so she prayed, but nothing happened. And so nothing happened for a while, so she said, well, I'll keep on preparing myself. So she went to college, and she got a four-year degree. And again, preparing. The Lord's called me. I want to go to China. This is what I want to do with my life. But 4 years, no man. And the night of her graduation, she knelt down, and she was a very, very angry young lady. And she laid it all out and said, God, you know what I want to do. You know I want to go to China. You know that I have prepared to serve you, and I only need one thing, and you couldn't even provide me a man. And she says, you know, I've given up everything for you. I've given you everything. And she said, in that moment, God impressed on her mind forcefully, no, see, the reason you're unhappy is not because you've given me everything, but because you've never given me everything. You've had it in your mind that you're going to be a hero, that you're going to go out there and you're going to save China, and that's happiness for you, and you're going to go out there and you're going to do lots of wonderful things, and you're going to live this adventurous life, and when everything is finished, they're going to build little statues to you. This is a saint. This is what a great woman of God looks like. That was your vision. And the truth of the matter is that you never gave up that vision. That was in your mind. You were going to be a super saint, a superhero. You never have actually given me your life, though. See, there's two ways to be lost. There's two ways to try to get something from God. See, listen to me. An armed bank robber looks a lot different than a gold digger. But they're the same thing. I mean, an armed bank robber may look fierce, he may have a gun, he may talk tough, he may be a forceful person, but he's there to get the money. A gold digger may be very sweet and very kind and very loving and very, very, you know, very, very, well, you know. She's just very, she's very, very, and very, very, very. And so, but she wants the same thing. She's out to get the money. She wants money as bad as the bank robber, but they're going about it in two very different ways. And see, it's very easy to come into Christianity. to be this kind of person who says, you know what, I'm going to be a good person. I want to have a family. I want to have kids. I'm going to serve in the church. I'm going to work in the church. I'm going to do all of these things in the church. But you know what? That's just your version of what happiness looks like for you. And in essence, you're not any different than the people you went to high school with whose version of happiness looked like the bar and the wild lifestyle. You're still just pursuing happiness, but you're pursuing it in a very religious way. Now, here's the problem that you and I have. It's very easy to know if you're the younger brother. You know how you know if you're the younger brother? Did you wake up with a hangover? You're a younger brother. Are you sleeping with people you're not married to? You're the younger brother. Are you out doing crazy stuff? Have you stole anything lately? You're the younger brother. I mean, it's very easy to know if you're the younger brother. But how do you know if you're the older brother? How do you know if I've been in church my whole life and I've done all the things that the preacher said that I should, and I went down and I said this prayer, you know, when I was in my teens, and I'm doing everything that I should. I mean, how do you know that essentially at the core, you're no different than the tax collectors and the prostitutes? How do you know you're any different than them? See, it gets very tricky. Timothy Keller tells about a situation. I might have shared this before. I can't remember what I've told you. I'm sorry. It's been a year, you know. Those first 12 sermons, I could stay fresh, but, you know, we're in the sermon 80 now, so I can't remember what I said. But he tells about this guy in college, and Keller was a leader in the Christian organization at his college, and they had a tremendous conversion, because they're a small group of 10 or 15 people, and they're just trying to win people to Christ, other students. And one of the students that converted was the campus ladies' man. I mean, I'd date myself here, but he was like the Sam Malone of the campus, all right? And so all the girls liked him, and he had this tremendous reputation as this womanizer in campus. So he came to a meeting one night, and he heard the gospel, and he gave his life to Christ. He says, so we were just ecstatic, because it's like we won the greatest sinner on the campus, and now we're going to go somewhere because now we can tell everybody, you know, this guy got converted. So, and he said, we'd love to tell people about his conversion, because it was so dark and black his life before, and now he's so pure. And he said, but something happened. And he said, I didn't have the theological sense to see it at the time. He said, it was only years after I graduated that I was able to reflect on what was actually happening in his life. He said, but after a few months with us, it became clear that he always had to have the last word. He said, we would have meetings, and he had an argumentative spirit about him, and he was very forceful, and he always had to win. He was sort of an antagonistic kind of guy. And he said, we just wondered about that, because God has saved him from so much, but it seemed like, you know, he had repented, he had changed, he wasn't drinking or chasing the girls anymore, and so he had become a Christian, but he had this little area that needed to be sanctified in his life. He said, but in retrospect, he said, what happened, I think, was this. He said, that man needed to feel like he was important, and the way that he felt important was through winning. That was who he was. That was at his core. And before he became religious, he felt important through conquering women. He would find them, they would date, things would happen, and he would feel important, and it was a notch on his belt. He said, when he came into our little Christian group, though, he said he didn't change at the core. He changed the means. Now, instead of conquering women, he had to conquer arguments in the church. And he said, it looked like he had become a Christian, but just needed a little work in this area. He said, but what happened was he never changed at the core. He changed the means. He was still the same person. He still had to feel important. And the way that he felt important was through winning. And now it wasn't with women, but it was in small groups in the church. At the core, he was the same. I've known people, I grew up in the church. I went to church 9 months before I actually appeared in the world, you know. And there are people who were bullies, and they would be in fights in bars before they came to Christ. And then when they came to Christ, they quit going to the bars. They were gloriously changed, but they were very much religious bullies. The means changed. They used to get in fist fights. Now they get in theological fights. But they still need to feel important. There are people outside of the world. And, you know, they crave attention. And they've got to, you know, they've got to be seen. They've got to be heard. And the way they do that outside is through dress and through behaviors. And through the way that they handle themselves. And then they become a Christian and they don't like maybe dress like that, or they don't do the same things they used to do to get attention, but now they're very religious, but they still have to be seen and heard. Now the church is their place to be seen and heard. See, it's very easy to change the means, but not really change what you're after. The core of you is still the same. The means may be different, but you are using God, you are using others to get what you want. At the core, there hasn't been this radical change where, you know what, I used to have to dominate people, but now I'm so humble, I'd never have to win another fight. Jesus Christ has loved me, He has saved me, I am complete in Him, and because I am complete in Him, I don't need to win to feel complete. There's just not that drive in me anymore. You know what, I used to feel the need to be seen and heard, and I needed to feel so important in life, but you know what? Jesus Christ loved me so much He died for me, and that makes me feel important enough, so I just don't have that desire to be seen and heard like I used to. It's just gone, it's clean. That's radical transformation. That's you getting the gospel and the gospel radically changing you. So at the core, you are an entirely different person than you used to be. But what often happens is you come in and you say, oh, something clicks in your mind. It's like, oh, I really want to be happy and I've got all these needs. And you know what? I don't think that you consciously do this, by the way, but I think somehow you come in and get a very incomplete view of what it means to be a Christian. And now you say, ooh, I used to go there, but I can get all that in the church. I can be, you know, loved in the church. I can be ambitious in the church. I used to be ambitious in the world, and I used to want to dominate, and I used to want to sit in the biggest chair in the world, and I used to have the corner office, but now, you know, in the church, there's corner offices too, you see. And so I can begin to climb, and I used to be able to, you know, be the head over here, but now I can be the head over here. See, you're just changing your means. The gospel hasn't affected you at the core. But again, how do you know you're the older brother? Because this is tricky, isn't it? How do you know at the core whether you've been changed or not? Look at this boy. Look at the symptoms. One of the symptoms that he had was perpetual anger beneath the surface. You see that in verse 28, where the father comes and they killed the fatted calf, and immediately what? There's anger there because the boy snaps. It's like, you never killed a calf for me. You never did that for me. You never killed a goat for me. Right under the surface, immediately, there's that anger that snaps. And older sons always have that perpetual anger. You know what an older son says? Because, see, they've come to God, but they've only come to God to get something. They're the gold digger. They're not the bank robber. They're the gold digger. They're still after the same thing, but they're using a different means. But you know what happens when you think like that? You're always thinking you got shortchanged. You're always thinking you got shortchanged. You know what the older son says? He says this. You know what? I go to church all the time. I worship. I pay my tithes. and nothing's happening. I'm not getting anything out of it. I pay my tithes and I'm not getting any richer. I mean, the people who don't pay tithes are getting richer than me, and I'm paying tithes. You know what? We raised our kids up in Sunday school. We raised our kids up in every children's thing. We had them there. You know what? They didn't turn out as good as the kids that lived down the street that never went to church. I mean, what good was that? You know, we've been in that church forever. Nobody ever asked me to teach a Sunday school class. Nobody wants me to do anything. We've been there forever. We're not applauded. Nobody ever rejoices. Nobody ever kills a fatted calf for me. See, the elder sons always have that anger. Elder sons are by nature very touchy because they're working. They're after the happiness and anything that gets in their way. It looks like a lack of sanctification. But it's probably more than that. It's probably a lack of salvation. Because nothing's changed. Notice something else. Not only is there that just this anger under the surface, but there's no joy in the work. Verse 29. He says this. Lo, these many years I have been serving you. Now, he could have said that different. Because this is a rich kid. I mean, he's living on an estate, and he's not a servant. Every day he's around, he's looking at people who have it worse than him. He lives in the manor house. But for him, I've been serving you all these years. Where's your joy at? You're a rich snot. You haven't been serving anything. I've been serving all these years. I've been working. There's no joy. You know what older sons do? Older sons don't get diddly squat out of worship. They don't. Worship's about putting in the time because, you know, if I don't worship, you know, if I don't show up, things don't work right for me, maybe, you know, and I'm putting in my time and, you know, I've got to hold my position. So you got the leadership levels and I got to go. But that's the way older sons worship. There's no joy in it. I mean, listen, it's a joy to worship the Lord. It's your privilege to come into his courts with thanksgiving. It's your honor. Most people don't get to do that. There's no joy in it for you. There's just work. I mean, you know what older sons say? We've been working here for 40 years and nobody's done anything for me. Listen, I thought it was a joy to get to work for the Lord. I thought it was an honor to get to serve him. I thought it was an elevation. I thought being a priest and a king with Jesus Christ was actually a good thing. No, we've been working here for 40 years and nobody's killed a fatted calf for us. No, they don't even ask our opinion anymore. They act like we don't even matter around here. This son and the father, can you believe the father let the son come back and didn't even ask the son about it? Can you believe that? And I've been working here for 40 years and they don't even care what I think. Haddon Robinson was a professor of mine of preaching, and Robinson was named by Newsweek some years ago as one of the 12 greatest living preachers in the English-speaking world. And he's written a textbook on preaching that sold over 300,000 copies. Now, when you can write a book on preaching that sells over 300,000 copies, you're doing something. And so he's sort of this tremendous guy in the realm of preaching. He was on over, I think, 500 radio stations with the radio Bible class. But anyway, where he's at, he's in a church of about 150 people, and they got a young preacher in, and he's telling us about this in class. They got this young guy in his 30s, it's 150 people, and there on the pew is Haddon Robinson, the guy who wrote the book about preaching. And he said, "You know, I went to the preacher," he said, "because, you know, I thought there might be some concerns with me sitting there." And he said, "This is what I told him." He said, "I want you, when you make decisions, to never think once about what Haddon would think. Just understand, never consider me in your decisions. You follow what God wants you to do, and whatever it is, I'll be behind you. But never have a decision that come up and say, you know, I don't know that I can do that. I don't know if Haddon would want that to, you know. Never, ever think that way. God's opinion is important, not mine. Don't ever consider my opinion when you make decisions. Well, think about that. What is that? That's not an older son. I mean, that mentality is, you know, it's a joy to be here. I just come here to worship the Lord. I just come here to care. I don't have to have the fatted calf killed for me. You don't have to live in terror of me. There's joy without service. There's moral superiority. You see that there, don't you? There's just this moral superiority. This son wasted all your money on harlots. I mean, can you hear that righteous indignation coming out of him? You know, I'm superior to him. I should be getting more than him. And that's the older son. I mean, that's the older son's mentality. I've done more. I've worked harder. I've been there when others weren't there. I deserve more. Look at this guy. I mean, listen, if you've been in this church forever and you look around this room, I mean, you ought to be able to look around this room and find at least 12 people who are far more holier than you are. And you say, no, I'm one of the 12. No, that means you're a really self-righteous snob. I mean, listen. I mean, if you've been in a church this long and you look around and you ought to, I mean, you know you got troubles when you're proud of your own humility, right? I mean, you can't be humble if you're proud of being humble. And you can't be righteous if you're aware of your righteousness. I mean, people who are righteous aren't aware of their righteousness. They feel like the worst guy in the room because they're aware of all the stuff. They're so in tune with God. They see God for who he is and they know that they don't compare to God. And they live so close to God that they are conscious that they're not like God. They don't feel the righteousness because they're close to perfection. He's morally above everybody else. It really comes down to this, though. He doesn't have a heart for what God has a heart for. That's the bottom line. The father wants to see his family together. The father wants to see his two boys together, loving each other, regardless of what the younger son has done. He's home now. Let's put it behind us. Let's love each other. Let's be a family. That's the heart of the father. And this guy is out of touch with the heart of the father. See, listen, that's the point. You can be lost because you're out of the presence of the father. But you can also be lost because you're out of sympathy with the heart of the father. Both put you in a lost condition. You've got to be in his presence, but you also have to be in sympathy with his heart. What the father wants is for those boys to get together. He wants that family to come together. He wants bygones to be bygones. He wants to embrace both of his boys, and it's tremendous that the boy goes out into the yard and the father chases him. I mean, he loves the older son as much as he loves the younger son. It's in his heart to go. It's interesting that this parable ends without an ending. They're just there in the field. The father says, all that I have is yours. I love you. I don't love you any less because I've embraced your brother. And there they are, and that's sort of the way it ends. In Hollywood, that would be a bad ending. But I think perhaps what Jesus is doing is he's allowing us to end it for ourselves. One thing the son could have done, which is reflected in the Gospels, this is the way it worked out in the Gospels, is he could have took a cross-shaped stick and rose up and killed his father. It's one way that could have ended. Another way it could have ended is for the older son to have gotten so mad that he just left home. He said, listen, if you're not going to honor my work here, if you're not going to honor my service, if you're not going to honor my good deeds, if you're not going to honor what I've done here, and you're going to equate me with this guy who just came home, I'm not staying here, I'm leaving. And that might have been the way that the parable should have ended, because he ends outside of the house. The prodigal, the first prodigal left, the second one is on his way out. And that's one way that it could have ended. The other way, though, is for the boy to have gone in the house. Because, see, listen, there's really three sons here, aren't there? See, there's the son who left and went to the far country. There's the son who stayed home but was out of sympathy with the father's heart. But there was the son who told the story, you see. And the son who told the story and is trying to get the point home is the son who came from heaven down to earth. He was born in poverty. He was born in a dirty barn. He spent his whole life without a home. He spent his entire ministry trying to reconcile people to the Father, to try to bring unity, to try to be an ambassador. And then in the end, he died for the sins of the world. I mean, and if you are in sympathy with him, if you belong to him, then you know what you almost have to do? You've got to be doing what he did. And if Jesus was in the story, he would have gone back in the house. See, I think that if you're raised in the church like I was raised in the church and like maybe some of you, you're always struggling with the temptation to be the older son. I never was really tempted greatly to be the younger son. But it's a daily struggle to me not to be like the older son. It just is. We all have our own temptations, and maybe that's your temptation. But listen, the temptation to be like the older son is no less a temptation to be like the younger son. Because Christian life isn't just about avoiding what the younger son got involved in, but it is avoiding becoming like the older son. An entitled person who says, I worked here, I deserve it. I'm first in line. Everybody else needs to get in line behind me. I'm not going to be on an equal ground with somebody who's done what he's done. It's a person who has lost the heart of God. And that's as great of a temptation as it is to go waste your money on the harlots, because it causes you to be lost just like wasting your money on the harlots did. Will you stand with me?